We'll hear argument next to number 9583, Alan Megrig versus KFC Western, Inc. Mr. Zames, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case, after all the briefing on a wide range of issues, remains a statutory interpretation case. And the guidance that this court has previously given on how to resolve such cases, particularly where Congress has provided direct indications of its intent in several ways, we think charts a very clear path for how the case should be resolved. Let me digress for just a moment to talk about the facts in this case that are, at this stage, undisputed. This is still a pleading case, notwithstanding the many twists and turns that it has been through. The case concerns a small commercial property located on a street corner in Los Angeles that was owned by petitioners from 1963 to 1975. The petitioners sold the property to Respondent in 1975. Respondent had been a tenant on the property for about 10 years before that, since 1965, and had operated a Kentucky Fried Chicken store on the property. In 1988, Respondent decided that it would bulldoze that Kentucky Fried Chicken store, bulldoze also the strip mall that was alongside it, and put a brand new store on the property. It was going to be a two-story Art Deco specially designed store, and in the course of that work discovered contamination on the property by refined petroleum product. That was in October 1988. The respondent fully cleaned up the contamination in a matter of months, by March 1989, and gave notice to petitioners under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, what we call RCRA in shorthand, in May 1990. It was not, though, until December 1991, more than 3 years after the contamination had been discovered, that respondent commenced its first action in state court, alleging in toto 10 different causes of action, most of them sounding in common law, but two under state statutes.
Was the cleanup done pursuant to an order of the municipality?
It was done under the supervision of the County of Los Angeles Department of Health Services. I don't believe that there was an order in effect at the time that the cleanup was done, but they had general oversight.
Had a building permit been conditioned on the cleanup?
I believe it had.
So the respondent was under really a legal duty to clean up the property, at least if the building permit were going to be granted.
I'm not sure if that is an allegation of the complaint, but I believe that that would have been the state of facts at the time that the cleanup was done. After two successful demurs by petitioners, that case went up on appeal to the state court, and this action was filed in the federal district court in Los Angeles, alleging a single cause of action under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That was in May 1992. Now, it is Congress's intent in the citizen suit provision of that statute that we are here to determine. And we believe that the congressional intent derives from several sources, including the plain words of the jurisdictional statement of the statute, other related sections of the statute, the legislative history of the statute itself.
Well, Mr. Zames, there are two potential questions that I guess we might resolve, and I'm not sure if we have to resolve them both or not. One has to do with the statutory requirement that an imminent and substantial endangerment be alleged.
Yes.
And that may possibly be decisive for purposes of this case. The other has to do with what's recoverable, assuming there is a valid claim made, and the extent of a court's equitable authority. What does that cover? Are you going to address both those issues?
I am going to address both of those.
And do we need to decide both, in your view?
I believe you do need to decide both, and the primary reason that you need to decide both is that part of the way that this case has come to this court is that there is a conflict in the circuits. The Ninth Circuit has fundamentally determined that as to the second issue, what type of relief is available under the statute, that a cost recovery action may be pursued. The Eighth Circuit has determined precisely the opposite.
That's the question on which there is a split of authority.
That is the question on which there is a split of authority. It is less clear that there's a split on the imminent substantial endangerment.
Doesn't the Ninth Circuit create the split?
I'm sorry, Justice Breyer?
Doesn't the Ninth Circuit create the split on the question of when the endangerment had to take place?
My recollection of the Ninth Circuit says the endangerment can be in the past or in the present.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure that the Eighth Circuit reached the issue of whether it has to be past or present directly. It relied more on the Court v. Ash analysis of whether there was an implied right of action for damages in the case. In addition to the words of the statute, we have legislative history in this instance.
I'm sorry, I'm just not quite clear on your why you answered that we must decide both, because if we say that the Ninth Circuit was wrong about when the endangerment must be, if we say it is an imminent yet to be realized danger, why do we have to answer any other question? The Ninth Circuit is then reversed, and your client has no responsibility.
Well, that resolves the situation, Justice Ginsburg, for my client. I agree. I'm not sure that that resolves the remainder of the Ninth Circuit's decision. If you were to only reverse...
But we can decide this controversy only. We decide a live case or controversy, and your controversy is over once you prevail on the point that there was, at the time this action was taken, that the suit was brought, no imminent danger of any kind.
That would resolve this case fully, and the reason...
We could attack it from the other direction,
and could
determine that there's no cause of action for money damages.
That is true.
And therefore, it doesn't matter whether or not this thing was prior or not. So,
you could resolve it that way also. And my answer to Justice O'Connor was that because there is the conflict, I was keying off of
The second point is the one on which there is the conflict.
The second point is the one on which there is the clear conflict, yes. Now, in addition, I will say that this case has engendered a considerable amount of activity just since the Ninth Circuit came down. I'm speaking outside the record, but as a matter of policy, if the court wanted to resolve the issue of the of what RCRA entitles a person to do, it could reach both issues for the reason that if it only resolves imminent substantial endangerment, then the likelihood of there being recurring issues on what type of relief is available is going to be great. But the fundamental reason is there is a conflict in the circuit, but Justice Scalia, you're referring.
What if we had a case where there is an imminent substantial endangerment alleged, and the plaintiff says, I want an injunction and I want an order that the defendant will pay the costs of future cleanup. Is that within the court's equitable power?
This is an order that the defendant would clean it up now, or the order would say, plaintiff, you may clean it up, and we are going to order defendant to pay that.
Either way.
In the first instance, if the order were simply plaintiff will clean it up and defendant will reimburse, I don't believe that the court is entitled to issue that sort of order, because what the statute says is the district court may restrain or order such person to take such other action. What is contemplated by that is that the defendant is going to undertake the cleanup, not that some money damage award is going to issue. And that's the fundamental basis of our position in the case.
What if the court makes exactly such an order and says, defendant, stop what you're doing now, clean up. And the defendant doesn't, either because the defendant can't get its hands on the money to pay for it or is just contumacious and whatnot. Can the plaintiff at that point come in and say, all right, you've made a perfectly proper order here, but nothing is getting done. Authorize me to, in effect, take whatever steps I can take to abate and to clean up, simply to discharge the responsibility which is ultimately upon this other party. Under those circumstances, could the plaintiff get, and the court says, yes, all right, go ahead. Under those circumstances, could the plaintiff get restitution?
I don't believe that it could under this statute. Now, bear in mind, this is one statute And this is one remedy in a broad array of remedies that are available. So while we're focusing on this statute and what it provides...
But you would still win the case if that were the rule here, wouldn't you?
I would
if we accept your position on imminence. You'd still win the case if that were the rule here.
Justice Souter, I believe that I would win on the RCRA claim. I believe that I would lose on several other claims. I would lose any of several state law claims.
Oh, but we're not adjudicating.
I understand.
We're talking about RCRA, and under the RCRA claim, you would win, would you not?
Way this statute is framed, I believe that I would win in that sort of situation, because...
So you want a broader rule than the rule that it would take you to win the case.
Well, I'm seeking in some... And we've touched on this in the context of the imminent substantial endangerment. The imminent substantial endangerment issue disposes of my case. But
I assume you're here arguing your client's case, not bringing interesting issues to us.
That's
your client would win on the position that I have suggested, wouldn't it?
It would.
And that would end this lawsuit.
It would.
But you're trying to take the high ground, as I understand it. You think that the more defensible principle is a principle that not only lets your client win, but lets some other people win.
Well, I'm taking fundamentally the position that I win on either one. I win on the imminent and substantial, and I also win on what the scope of relief is that is afforded.
You not only want to win, you want to win on the basis of a correct principle, which is what you're arguing here.
Absolutely correct, Justice.
Now, then to go to the correct principle, how could you, in fact, interpret this statute to say that a plaintiff could never get monetary damages? Suppose the gasoline station next to you is, in fact, right now leaking gasoline through your wall, killing your chickens or whatever. And what you do is you have to put up a barrier to stop it, and at the same time you run into court and you say, enjoin it. So the court says, enjoin it. You say, I've spent $50,000 on the gasoline barrier to keep my chickens safe, and I'd like to be reimbursed for that. Are you saying that wouldn't be necessary give you the little extra money that you needed in order to take immediate action within a few hours in order to stop all your livestock from dying or whatever? Normally in equity, I think that kind of restitution would be normal. And so what's the argument on the merits that this statute wouldn't give you that, even though that's not in this case at all, totally hypothetical? But
with all those assumptions, the argument is that is the way this statute is structured.
Right, the word in the statute is necessary, and how would you say that kind of normal, equitable relief, which is the principle you want to argue for, never could be necessary?
Well, with all due respect, Justice Breyer, the wording of the statute is order such person to take such other action as may be necessary.
And isn't it necessary in the circumstance, given the history of equity, etc., to make at least the monetary restitution necessary to clear up the absolute immediate emergency action that the plaintiff took in order to save the lives of his livestock?
Well, fundamentally, because our argument is that is not what Congress intended. Congress intended to...
Why not?
Why? Because in the broader scheme of things, the citizen suit remedy in this statute, as in its predecessors, is designed to afford limited relief to plaintiffs. And not to have plaintiffs coming in with all sorts of money damages claims.
I agree with that. That's why I say you're arguing for the proposition never. And that's what's bothering me. Never.
I'm arguing for the proposition never under this statute.
Mr. Zames, you're second. We may be unfair to you in severing the two points as though they don't overlap. As I understand it, part of your argument with regard to the damages point hinges upon your assertion that this is a statute that is only intended to prevent future harm, is not intended to remedy for past harm.
That is true.
And in the hypothetical that Justice Breyer just posed to you, what you are doing is reimbursing the plaintiff for that past damage that he's incurred for putting up the barrier. And there's no doubt that he would not be able to get that if we take the first point in the case. There's no doubt that he would not be able to get that once, although he's put up the barrier, once all of the oil pollution next door has been eliminated, he has no cause of action at all, neither for putting up the barrier nor for anything else. And part of your argument is that these two halves go together. When you understand that the statute is only intended to remedy for future harm, there's no sense in allowing a court to give damages for something that happened in the past.
That is the part of the argument, and that is what the statute provides, and that's fundamentally and is un.
But suppose that the court ordered the previous owner to clean up under this statute with proper notice, and the owner is contumacious, does not obey the court's order, and the plaintiff then, giving due notice again of his intent, undertakes to clean up the and stop the waste himself. As an ordinary measure of contempt of court sanctions, is not the plaintiff entitled to recover the cost that he expended to avoid the harm that the defendant, in contempt of the court's order, refused to undertake on his own?
Well, perhaps as a matter of contempt, and I'm glad you raised that, Justice Kennedy, because I was contemplating that when Justice Souter asked a similar question earlier. But again, the statute, this particular statute, provides a limited array of remedies. And while in the situation you've described, if the contumacious defendant does not clean up, there may be a remedy available under sanctions principles. And that may get the plaintiff to the same point he would otherwise be.
Well, aren't there cases holding that courts retain equitable authority not specifically taken away by Congress?
There are those cases. Those cases have been cited by respondent.
Right. And you recognize the validity of that notion.
The court does retain equitable power, and the limits on that equitable power are circumscribed by the particular statute at issue. And fundamentally, where we part company with respondents in the line of cases that starts from Porter and traces its way through Franklin v. Gwinnett is that we are faced with a much different statute than was at issue either in Porter or the
But in my hypothetical case, you cannot get the power of the court to order that limited measure of damages from the phrase, take such other action as may be necessary?
Well, again, since the phrase is actually order such person to take such other action, the phrase seems to be even more limited than the part that you're quoting, Justice Kennedy, in all due respect. And it seems to aim more at requiring somebody to undertake acts as opposed to requiring a payment of some sort.
I thought your argument was that given your position on the first point as to whether the statute is directed only to the prevention of future harm, extant threats, that the phrase as may be necessary must reasonably be read to mean as may be necessary to achieve the purpose of this statute, which is not to reimburse for past expenses, but to prevent future harms.
It can be read that way.
Now,
well,
if you...
Is that your reading?
Well, my reading is that the statute has a limited...
No, but Justice Scalia just set out a position. I thought... At one point, I thought that was the way you read it. Is that the way you read it?
The way I read the statute, and I was taking Justice Scalia's comments in the context of Justice Kennedy's question, but fundamentally, the way I read the statute is the statute says that you can address an imminent harm, you can take steps to prevent future harms, and that is what is afforded.
And that is what circumscribes the court's power as a court of equity to make orders and provide remedies. Isn't that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that is true.
All right. If that is the... I didn't mean to take your question
away.
I'm sorry. If that is the case, then why shouldn't your answer to my first question be different? Because the assumption of my first question is... We have, in fact, a situation which is presenting imminent harm here. The court says, stop it. Stop doing what you're doing. Clean up enough so that there is no further imminence of harm. The threat will be gone. The defendant says no, or simply does not do it. All the plaintiff wants is to get to that point which the court had every authority to order the defendant to reach. And so the plaintiff says, let me clean up and then give me restitution for doing what you had the authority to order the defendant to do. Why doesn't a court have that authority?
Take it, Mr. Zaves. Take it.
I'm about to. I think the court does.
Okay.
Because you're starting from a point where the court exercises its jurisdiction initially consistent with the statute. And another way to look at it is that the court is simply following up on something that it initiated under the jurisdiction that was given to it originally.
And once you say that, then aren't you back into a line-drawing problem that the statute doesn't give a damages remedy? That's true. But a statute may give a remedy to require a person to pay money to the plaintiff insofar as that's an equitable action related to the basic cleaning up of the spill. I mean, I don't know exactly how to draw that line, but the line between the equitable remedy for money, which is ancillary to the injunction, and a damages action would seem the right line, do you
not,
think?
Not necessarily, because the way I get to the ability to award damages in the hypothetical posed by Justice Souter and then by Justice Kennedy is the jurisdiction is invoked initially pursuant to the statute to remedy a future harm or an imminent endangerment. And then damages are awarded in furtherance of that. The jurisdiction has already been exercised. So the example you're giving, Justice Breyer, is a lot broader and does enter into some line-drawing problems.
Do you have an answer to the, I think, main criticism of your reading, which is that it encourages delay on the part of the person on the spot? It says to that person, don't clean it up, because if you do, it's going to be out of your own pocket. Instead, let the contamination increase and go sue somebody else.
I have three very brief answers to that. Number one, we as parties litigating and the court are limited by what Congress has provided, number one. And the scheme that Congress has provided provides a 90-day notice provision, and then by implication, in some situations, would require a plaintiff to wait. Secondly, by giving notice, there is some likelihood that, particularly with a serious endangerment, that the EPA or the state or the alleged contaminator are going to come in and do some action. So the argument advanced by respondents that we are going to have hazardous waste sites that are continuing to damage the environment and damage human health isn't necessarily so. And thirdly, within the statute itself, and the statute is contained in the appendix to respondents' brief, there is a provision, and it's within the notice provision. The notice says 90 days to the EPA, to the state, and to the contaminator. There is a provision that says, except where there is an allegation of a violation of subchapter 3 of the statute. And subchapter 3 is the portion of the statute that deals with hazardous waste. So presumably in a situation where you have hazardous waste, the plaintiff need not wait the 90 days if it is going in to remedy a hazardous waste situation. So those are my three responses to that argument. Mr. Chief Justice, may I reserve time on the remainder?
Yes, you may, Mr. Singh. Mr. Munir, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The initial and controlling issue in this case is whether a citizen plaintiff may seek relief under Section 7002A1B of RCRA if there is no current endangerment at the time of suit. We think the answer is clearly no. Section 7002A1B provides that for judicial relief in response to specific activities, namely the treatment, storage, or disposal of waste, that, quote, may present an imminent and substantial endangerment, end quote. The statute's use of the term may present indicates there must be a current endangerment at the time the suit is filed. That construction is borne out by Section 7002B2A, the so-called notice provision, which requires the plaintiff to provide notice to the defendant and also to the other government agencies of the endangerment before filing suit. Respondent attempts to avoid that construction by arguing that the limiting clause requiring endangerment actually refers to a description of the hazardous waste and not to the antecedent activities. The statute, however, will not afford that construction. Section 7002B2B, which appears at the bottom of appendix page 3 of respondent's red brief, states that a citizen suit is precluded if the EPA is taking action in response to, quote, activities that may present the alleged endangerment. For that reason, it is clear that Congress was referring to the activities and not the waste in using the term endangerment.
What, again, is your reference there, Mr. Munir?
That is at appendix page 3 of the red brief.
In what section?
It is 7002B2B.
Thank you.
The construction that we urge here is not only consistent with the statutory terms, but it is also consistent with the overall design of the statute, which is structured to abate existing hazards. For example, the statute makes reference to prospective remedies. It also provides the notice provision, as I discussed before, which provides for the elimination of the hazard and the avoidance of the suit. It also contains no statute of limitations respecting any damage claims that would thereby prevent any stale damage claims. In addition, the legislative history supports the construction that we urge. For example, House Report 198 describes the Section 7002A1B remedy as a limited abatement remedy. If you agree with us that the citizen must show an imminent and substantial endangerment at the time of suit, then the court need go no further in this case. The respondent did not show a current endangerment, and the Court of Appeals decision could be reversed on that basis alone.
We didn't take this case to get rid of the case. We took the case principally, I think, at least I did, to resolve the circuit conflict, which doesn't exist on this point, but rather exists on the second point. Why isn't it perfectly valid to attack the second point as to whether money damages are recoverable? And in the course of, I think that in order to decide that second point correctly, you have to incidentally reach the first point.
Well, I think there are two answers to that. First, I think it's important for this court to recognize that the preconditions for suit must be satisfied before we get to the issues of remedy. Now, obviously, they are related, but I think that it puts the court in a difficult position to address the question of remedies where no such remedy could be afforded in this particular case. Second, if you do resolve the case on the first issue, I think that might well cause the Court of Appeals to reconsider its reasoning with regard to the second issue. And it may well be that the circuit conflict that currently exists will dissipate as a result of your ruling on the first issue. In any event, I think that it is important for the court.
The opinion doesn't read that way, Mr. Manier. I think that's quite unlikely. I think maybe we ought to wade into it and find out what it is that the court can do in the way of damages.
Your Honor,
do you argue that the statute authorizes the court to award past cleanup costs as a remedy, or that it just doesn't prohibit it?
It doesn't expressly address the issue, but it does allow the court to allow relief that is necessary.
And well, do you say that actual money damages for past cleanup costs fits within that statutory description?
We think in certain circumstances a monetary remedy can be necessary to fulfill the purposes of the statute. The purpose of the statute here is to allow the courts to compel a responsible party that has created a current endangerment to abate that endangerment. And it will be in some circumstances necessary to apply a restitutionary type remedy to ensure that that purpose is fulfilled. For example, suppose that a plaintiff brings a suit and during the notice period asks the defendant to clean up the site. The defendant will have a powerful incentive not to take any action to clean up the site and to try to force the endangered community to assume those costs if it knows that the court will be unable to award any damages in those circumstances. I do not believe that's what Congress had intended in this situation. Moreover, the position that we take is consistent with the general view this court has expressed with regard to a court's equitable powers. This court has noted in various circumstances that a court may include a restitutionary remedy together with other equitable relief.
But this isn't a broad grant of just equitable jurisdiction. It's a much more circumscribed grant of a part of a court of equity's power.
Well, we think that the primary circumspection or limitation on the court's power is really the requirement of a current endangerment. Once there is a current endangerment, then it behooves the court to take those steps that are necessary to abate the endangerment, and also to assure that the responsible...
Well, do you think that the language to restrain any person, etc., and then to order such person to take such a... Is the sum and substance of what would be granted if the statute said the court shall have equitable jurisdiction?
Yes, we think it is. We think that it gives the same general grant of power with regard to any order that may be necessary. Equitable principles are circumscribed by the requirement of necessity, that the court must step in to prevent an injustice in a particular case. And we do think that the remedy...
I mean, not just an injustice, but an injustice that is related to eliminating an extant threat.
That is correct. Yes, I would agree with that.
As I hear you now, and as I heard Mr. Zames's concession in oral argument, I don't think you're disagreeing with Mr. Zames on this point anymore. As you seem to be originally, that is, he seemed to be taking the position in the briefs that you couldn't get money, period. Now I think he's acknowledged that you can get money so long as it is in connection with an order for somebody to remedy a threat to the environment.
If Mr. Zames has made that concession, then we are in substantial agreement on that point.
And I thought you went somewhat further, and let's take this case exactly, what the dates were. The contamination was discovered in October. Suppose the plaintiff had immediately given notice to the defendant, but during the 90-day period itself, under pressure, say, from town authorities, plaintiff starts cleaning up and then has to wait those 90 days to bring the suit. So by the time we get to, what would it be, February? From October to February, the plaintiff has already incurred a substantial sum. then from the time the suit begins in February until March when the cleanup is done and incurs further expenses, is it your position that all of the expenses during the 90-day period plus after suit commences are reimbursable or only after the suit commences?
It's our view that all of them may be reimbursable, but there are several other conditions that we would recognize. First of all, they have to be expenses that were reasonably necessary to abate the danger that was presented in this by the hazard that was proposed. There also had to be notice to the defendant with regard to these expenses and a decision by the defendant not to undertake them. And the reason why these expenses are assessable is because they are necessary to ensure that the statute works the way that Congress intended, namely that it would encourage the responsible party to clean up the site and eliminate the need for a suit. If the party refuses to do so, then it faces the additional costs that will be associated with reimbursing the plaintiff, in addition to the equitable order that might require the defendant to complete the cleanup of the site.
I don't see how that's necessary to achieve the purpose of the statute. The money, the cleanup that's been done with money already spent, those are sunk costs. That cleanup's been done. You don't achieve anything by paying the person for that.
Well, Congress is not simply wishing to see that the sites be cleaned up. They're also interested in seeing that the responsible parties would bear those expenses.
Not in this statute. Not in this statute, because you acknowledge that so long as the entire cleanup has been done before suit is lodged, you get none of your money back.
No,
or at least before the 90-day notice is given. You draw the line at the 90-day notice. You acknowledge that if I do somebody else's cleanup and complete it entirely so that there's no more harm to the environment, I cannot get anything under this statute.
May I answer that question? We draw a different distinction with regard to that line that Congress drew, and that is that it was concerned with directing the court's resources to imminent hazards, those that required immediate abatement. And once you cross that threshold, the court has its full equitable power. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Muneer. Mr. Romano, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice Rehnquist, may it please the court. I think that in light of the concessions that were made by counsel for the petitioner, I believe that about one half of my argument is no longer necessary. As I understand the petitioner's viewpoint now, assuming that we've complied with the statute, then we are entitled to seek equitable restitution under the statute if the reimbursement cost and the cleanup action that we took was, quote, necessary under the statute. We don't disagree with that.
No, I don't think that was the concession. I think the concession was that the court could issue an order which tells you to clean it up and requires the other party to pay you for your cleanup. That's not here.
But,
well, he hasn't conceded that he owes you any money.
What
he conceded is that a court could issue an order allowing the party now in possession of the property to clean up the hazard, the extant hazard, and saying, when you clean it up, you will be paid for, but it will be paid for by the other party.
In other words, the availability of restitutionary remedies is present in the statute, and this is about one half of our argument. Now, how do
Well, I'm not sure he can tell us later, as he's reserved time, what he conceded and what he didn't. I think you should address the argument of whether or not the statute permits the award of what, in essence, are monetary damages. The government cites rent control cases where there was restitution, the Moore case and I think the Porter case.
That's correct.
Those were decided well before our opinion in Court versus Ash.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the opinion in Court v. Ash really does not address the issue over here. The opinion in Court v. Ash dealt with whether or not the court should imply a private cause of action from a statute. What we have over here, we have a cause of action which is presumed to exist under the statute in light of the Porter decisions and Franklin decision, which Congress is presumed to have known about at the time that it enacted the statute. The language of the statute in Porter and the Franklin cases and in this case are virtually identical. They grant the court to authority to issue such other order as may be necessary. This language has been held by this court in the precedent that we cited to include all available equitable relief.
Well, there's nothing implied about the cause of action here, is there?
No, it's an explicit.
Any person may commence a civil action on his own behalf.
Precisely.
It's just a question of when he can do it and what he can get as a result of it.
Precisely, Your Honor. That's why we say that we're dealing here with an explicit grant of jurisdiction and authorization for any person, citizen, to commence an action on his own behalf. against all of the named defendants are under the conditions stated in the statute. So we don't have to deal with Court v. Ash, and this is where the Eighth Circuit was wrong. Now, we say that under the words of the statute, the court can do a number of things. They can issue a prohibitory injunction. It can issue a mandatory injunction, ordering, in fact, the cleanup of the property by the defendant. And this point is conceded by the defendants. We say it is a very small step from there to allow the court to say, under the circumstances of the case, if appropriate and if necessary, you, plaintiff, go out, clean the property, and then you will obtain reimbursement from this defendant.
Yes, after the case is pending, after the case is pending and there is still cleanup to be done, the court could order that. I tend to agree with you. But that's not what happened here. The cleanup was done years ago before the suit was filed.
Justice Scalia, let me respond to some comments that you made which bear on this point. Earlier you stated, I believe, that it was your view of the statute that it applies to prevent future contamination. But if, in fact, if you look at the statutory objectives stated in RCRA itself, Section 42 U.S.C. 6902B, the Congress said it is the intent, the national policy of the United States, and I'm skipping ahead over here, to minimize the present and the future threat to human health and the environment. This is what we did in this case. So the only issue is...
Not to shift money around with respect to past threats.
Well,
present and future, but not past.
The issue is that is presented before this court is what should a property owner do upon the discovery of contamination in his property? Now, he can do one of two things. We have to assume in the context of this decision that contamination presents an imminent hazard condition. Now, what does that mean? It means you have a drums of toxic waste leaking to the groundwater. It means that there is a condition whereby there is a discharge into the soil where children are playing. It may be that there is a potential explosive conditions that need to be abated. Would you rather have a plaintiff take care of those position, of those conditions and then seek his response later, or would you like him to go to court? The answer to this court provides...
I might have enacted a different statute. Is that what you're asking me?
No, Your Honor. I believe that this is precisely what Congress has enacted by...
Then why didn't they use the same words, encompassing words, that were used in CERCLA? I think you're asking us to interpret this provision of RCRA with the same breath as the CERCLA provision.
Justice Ginsburg, this is a very different statute from CERCLA. In fact, it is unique. No other statute is found in the environmental laws of the United States which allows a citizen to proceed and file and deal with an imminent hazard condition. CERCLA doesn't have that. A citizen.
I'm talking about what you can recover. Provision for reimbursement for cleanup costs is broad in CERCLA, is it not?
Yes.
And here, there is no similar provision that says, for what you've done to clean it up, you can recover.
We believe that Congress could have put the imminent hazard endangerment provision in CERCLA. It did not. It put it in RCRA so that the broadest possible remedies will be available to deal with conditions of imminent and hazard endangerments. Now, if Congress put that statute in CERCLA, it would only apply, Justice Ginsburg, to substances covered by CERCLA, which is a hazardous substances. Congress has well understood that environmental contamination, which may lead to imminent and hazardous conditions, may arise not only from hazardous substances, but also from solid waste and hazardous waste. Substances which are not covered by CERCLA. Moreover, Congress has understood that petroleum contamination is not covered by CERCLA, yet may present an imminent hazard condition. We believe that's why Congress put that statute in RCRA, not in CERCLA. There was a reason for what Congress did that.
Well, what's your position, Mr. Romano, with respect to a situation where a property owner discovers the hazard, goes ahead and cleans it up so that there's no longer any imminent or substantial endangerment, and then goes to court? What can he recover in the way of a monetary award?
Well, I believe that under the proper circumstances, this particular individual may recover may obtain equitable restitution of his environmental cleanup costs, those costs that were necessary, in the words of the statute.
So you say then he doesn't have to present an imminent and substantial endangerment to health?
We don't believe that the condition of imminent and substantial endangerment has to be present at the time of the filing of the lawsuit. Now, we believe that the statute supports us on this issue. when Congress wanted to put a limitation on the timing of the filing of the lawsuit in this statute, it imposed them in subsection B of the statute. Congress said no action may be commenced until several things have happened. One, you provide notice to the state, to the EPA, and to all the responsible parties. And then if within a period of 90 days the EPA or the state does not commence any remedial activities, then you may go to court and file a lawsuit.
It's but in two, which is the what says what the court can do, it refers to the endangerment. Surely that's referring back to an imminent and substantial endangerment.
The limitation of the endangerment is not temporal. For sure, an endangerment has to exist at the time of the cleanup. Otherwise, we will not be here. But assuming that an endangerment exists at some point in time, then should the person at that time file legal proceedings, send notice? In many cases, there's literally hundreds of defendants that are...
Well, but that may be a good argument as... one of my colleagues said, for a different statute, but it seems to me that this statute does require an imminent and substantial endangerment at the time you bring the lawsuit.
Your Honor, the only words that even hint on that is the language may present, which granted is in the present tense. We think that
Wait a minute,
is
now
a
what about subsection 1, which you say sets forth the conditions? What about 1B? It seems to me 1B makes no sense except on the assumption that this is a statute which deals with pending threats. That is, it says, no action may be commenced under Section A1A, A, prior to 60 days, or B, no action may be commenced, if the administrator or state has commenced and is diligently prosecuting a civil or criminal action in a court of the United States to require compliance with such permit, standard, regulation, condition, requirement, prohibition, or order.
Your Honor, we are not dealing with compliance.
Why would you eliminate somebody's cause of action for past damages so long as a state is pursuing a remedy to enjoin any future violation? It makes no sense.
If I understand Your Honor's question, it deals with violation of standards or permit conditions or so forth. This is not what we're dealing in this lawsuit. The Recreational Citizen Supervision is divided into two parts. Part A1A, which deals with lawsuits commenced by citizens to enjoin violations which are alleged to be against defendants which are alleged to be in violation. This is a lawsuit which is similar to many other statutes found throughout the environmental laws, and they are aimed into enforcement of the regulatory aspect of the statute. The statute we're dealing with today is a very different species of citizen supervision. It is unique, and it is a liability statute. And it says, and now under, it allows a party to initiate proceedings when the conditions of imminent and substantial endangerment exist. So the question is, does the may language, may present language, is it a language which is temporal or is it really something else? We believe it's something else. It is necessary to limit the whole universe of solid and hazardous waste, about the broadest universe of substances you can imagine, to those ones which may present an imminent substantial endangerment.
But that's just bad English. We do not assume that Congress uses bad English. I mean, to convey the thought you've just expressed, they would have said may exist or may have existed. What you're saying may exist means simply there's a possibility. There is or was a possibility. But that's not how we say that in English. The way we say that in English is may exist or may have existed.
Your Honor,
when we say may exist, we mean, what we mean is may exist.
Yeah,
now.
I understand that there is, for sure, there is an ambiguity in the way the statute is written. And we believe that our...
You missed my point. My point is there is no ambiguity. Not if you're speaking English. May exist or may have existed is the meaning you say may exist conveys. It does not convey that meaning.
Your Honor, we believe that when Congress wanted to put limitations on when such lawsuits should be filed, it put them under the actions prohibited section. That language is not found over there. What the petitioners are arguing is take some language which we believe is out of context. It's a descriptive language defining the type of waste that presents the hazard conditions and reading that into the jurisdictional section of the statute, which comes later on.
Well, would you say the same thing about the A1B's list of potential defendants, like a present generator or something, that those are just kind of illustrative and you could bring an action against lots of other people too?
you can bring an action under the terms of the statute against all past and present owners, or not owners, transporters, basically all the group of defendants which are alleged to have contributed in some fashion to the contamination of the property. And Congress has clearly stated that under this statute, it is the desire of Congress to have all of these defendants share equitably in the cleanup of the contamination. If I may, Your Honor, any other reading of the statute, the reading urged by the petitioners in this case, will lead to what we believe will be perverse results, because the bottom line is you have a property owner which has discovered a condition of imminent and substantial endangerment on his property. What you want him to do to preserve his legal rights, he will not really have absolutely no incentive to do any cleanup activities whatsoever on the property.
Well, I thought your client made the cleanup because ordered to do so by the city of Los Angeles. I didn't think this was some voluntary thing.
Your Honor, there was actually never an order. What the city...
You had to do it.
The city said, if you want to build your restaurant on this property, you better take care of that problem. And what my client did is voluntarily go out and investigate the nature of the problem, only to find out that the extent of... that, A, the problem was petroleum contamination, but to make matters worse, the bottom pile of petroleum actually hit the groundwater beneath the property. That's what we believe contributed to the conditions of imminent and substantial endangerment. At that time, the court has to ask us, that is the critical point in time here.
Well, you still have some state causes of action here, presumably.
Your Honor, our experience in this case is that we actually do not. We are now pending for the second time in the Court of Appeal before the state of California. And we don't think those state remedies have much meaning. But even if they did, the statute does not specifically state that a citizen may proceed in action under this section without regard to any other available remedies. There's a savings clause. The legislative history specifically says a plaintiff does not need to exhaust all other remedies before he commences a lawsuit under this section.
Isn't that make sense? That is to say, I take it the reason you lost in state court was because the state court found that the Merrigs never undertook any acts which caused gasoline contamination on the property. And so if you want a damages action, perhaps you should have to go against the people who caused the problem. But if you want a cleanup action, perhaps it's a better idea to get a broader category of people.
That's correct.
Which would argue then against using this statute simply to try to get damages for something that's over and done with in the past.
That's correct, Your Honor. We agree with that.
But then how would you win? Because you're trying to sue against something that happened in the past. So, maybe I don't understand it.
But
you're trying to go against some people whom the state found didn't cause the contamination. But nonetheless, they did handle the gasoline in the past, and it all was a problem in the past. But you want to get damages from them now, don't you?
No, we do not. We do not want to get
what you're calling restitution, you want to be reimbursed from them who didn't cause the problem for your expenditure. And it sounds to me as if it would make sense to let you get the reimbursement from a person who did cause the problem, which is what the state court would allow, but not necessarily to get reimbursement for a past event from people who are basically innocent, which is what you want to interpret the federal statute to allow.
Your Honor, the issue as to whether or not, in fact, we are entitled to obtain restitution from the Merrigs is really not before the court today. If the court, in fact, agrees with us and the case is remanded to the district court may, using equitable principles, decide whether or not we are entitled to restitution.
May I ask another question that you could answer, is not strictly before us. Why was there no effort to sue anybody until after the cleanup was done? That's one question. And the other is, are you telling us that unlike state law, the Merrigs, even if they had nothing to do with the contamination, are responsible under the federal statute?
Your Honor, in response to the second question, we believe that the Merrigs are responsible under state law, and in fact that's why we took an appeal from that order that was attached to as an exhibit, an appendix to the petitioner's brief. And
what about under the federal statute that says has contributed or who is contributing? These are people who say, let's assume for the moment that what they say is correct, we didn't, during our period of ownership, we didn't have a clue that there was any petroleum involved.
That, in fact, we believe is incorrect. Now, we're talking about facts, Your Honor, which are outside of the record and based on discovery that we obtained in the state court proceedings. And I'm happy to talk about those. They're not in this.
Let's assume, I said, that they're correct, that the gas station long preceded their ownership of this property, that they did not contribute to the contamination. They were not operating a gas station. It was a vacant lot while they were owners. Are they nonetheless contributors?
Under state law,
No, under this statute.
They may well be deemed to have contributed under the federal statute if they had discovered the presence of contamination on the property and did absolutely nothing about it, that's what the facts showed. So
I thought there was discovery wasn't made until that your client wanted to do this building.
Discovery by my client wasn't made, but we had found that there was, we believe that certainly the negligence agents, their father and the contractor that was managing the property on their behalf, certainly they are the entities that removed the underground tanks. And we have photographs which showed what the soil looked like. The soil clearly looked very heavily contaminated. So we believe that the Negrigs knew or certainly should have known about the fact of contamination on the property.
Then if you can go to my other question, what impeded you, faced with this statute that says may present, from beginning suit at the earliest possible time?
We were faced with a situation where the issue was either go to federal court and litigate this for obtain an order at the very minimum 90 days, but more likely several months or years down the line, maybe all the way up to this court before we could do anything about the property. Meanwhile, my client has...
Well, not according to the government's interpretation. The government said as long as you did your cleanup within the 90-day period, as the government reads the statute, you would be entitled to reimbursement. So my question is why timely suit wasn't commenced and cleanup commenced instead of saying we'll do the whole thing and then we'll attempt to sue for past.
I think that the short answer to that one, Your Honor, is that at the time that my client found out about the contamination, he was more concerned about taking care of the problem as opposed to suing people for recovering of his cleanup costs.
Good answer.
And thank you, Your Honor. Well, the government's position is an interesting position because we don't agree with that, obviously. And the reason for that is that the government says, okay, if you find contamination, what you do is you have to start providing notices to people, assuming you can locate all of those people, before you do any cleanup activities. Only after you provided notice to all of the defendants can you then follow with the filing of a lawsuit. We believe that such a reading of the statute will really contravene the congressional purpose in enacting the statute, which is if you have a condition which is by definition the worst type of environmental contamination, what you would want to do is clean it up and then work out the details as to who is responsible. And I would say that principles of equity, which govern the statute, provide all of the necessary restrictions on enlarging this kind of action. A district court on remand can decide and hold that we acted as an officious intermeddlers. A district court can decide that the costs that we've incurred were not necessary. And the district court may decide that we sat on our rights and laches is available. Certainly, I don't think people will be bringing those kind of lawsuits without, if they didn't have any merit to them, when they're facing with an attorney's fees and cost penalty in the event that they lose the lawsuit. So we believe that it is entirely appropriate for the court to hold that a plaintiff may, in the limited circumstances where the contamination presents an imminent and substantial endangerment to health and the environment, do whatever is necessary to obey those conditions and then sue under this statute to recover his costs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Romano. Mr. Zames, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'll cover only 3 points in that two-minute time, if I may. First, I began to discuss the line of cases cited by respondent, beginning with Porter v. Warner Holding and ending up more recently in Franklin v. Gwinnett County. Those cases are cited for the proposition that there is a broad equitable power in federal courts that can be called on in this situation. And if we look at Porter as the beginning of that line, Porter was a case in which the words of the statute were much different from those here. Porter had a statute that allowed the court to issue an injunction or other order, significantly broader than what we have here. And the court, in that case, looked at the legislative history and determined that the legislative history of that statute, the Emergency Price Control Act, was consistent with a reading that allowed the court, the lower court, to order the apartment owner to reimburse monies collected over the limits set by the Emergency Price Act. In the Franklin case, there was no congressional guidance on the limitations of remedies under that statute. Franklin arose under Title IX, and the right of action had been found to be an implied right of action under Cannon versus University of Chicago. So what the court determined was that there were full remedies available where Congress has not spoken as to the nature of the remedies. Since Congress hadn't even expressly indicated the right of action, they hadn't indicated the remedies either. Here we have an abundance of guidance. We have the language of the statute. We have legislative history of this and predecessor statutes and even of the CERCLA amendments in 1986, all of which point to a very limited reading, a limited availability of remedies under this citizen suit provision. And we have a comparable statute, RCRA, which, as Justice Ginsburg notes, has a full discussion of the kinds of limitations that are placed on plaintiffs seeking to recover their costs. Second point I want to make with respect to the contumacious plaintiff example. We must remember that state law covers those contumacious plaintiffs in abundance, as does CERCLA in all but petroleum contamination cases.
Thank you, Mr. Zanes. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until Tuesday, January 16th at 10 o'clock.